If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So punk and pop icon Debbie Harry helped rewrite the rules in a field that prided itself on its lack of rules. Blondie was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, and now 40 years later, they are still making new music. Their latest was 2014's Ghost of a Download, and you can see Blondie in concert in Chicagoland at the Genesee Theater this Friday, June 10th, and just north of the border at the Milwaukee Pride Fest on Sunday, June 12th, and that is music icon Debbie Harry. Hello there, Debbie.
Hi. How are you, David?
I am thrilled and honored to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's great to be around. We were just out here in L.A. working on new music, so I'm all, you know, stoked.
Very cool. Well, you know, you changed so much in rock and pop music. You were the first female rock singer who was not only beautiful but extremely talented and just edgy and completely incredibly cool.
Thank you very much. It's a lot to live up to.
No, it's totally true, and you have lived up to that. So, you know, I know, as a teenager, you grew up in suburban New Jersey, and you would venture into the West Village, and you would check out the theater scene when you were younger, and you really wanted to be a part of that. You wanted to be a part of something exciting.
Well, you know, I think I was really trying to explore, you know, what was going on in the art world and in theater, I guess. I like to read a lot. You know, I'm sort of an avid reader, and you know, seeing all these different articles about the scene in New York, and it all seemed very wonderful and magical to me, so of course I had to go and check it out.
But you know, and I know, and I've seen you do some interviews before. You know, you were kind of, and I've seen you quoted as being saying you were kind of oversexed, really charged, and you really wanted to get out of your suburban town, and that's kind of what ventured you into New York. New York was kind of your calling.
Well, I think so. You know, but I have to honestly say that. You know, even as a tiny little girl, you know, like a, you know, a four-year-old and a five-year-old, I was fortunate enough to live in that area and was taken by my family into the city for big holidays, you know, like a real tourist.
Sure.
And, you know, to go see the big tree at Rockefeller Center or to go to see the Easter show at Rockefeller, you know, at the theater. So I would... you know, I had those things, you know, be feeding me, you know, sort of the I knew that it was all there and it was so wonderful and so big and, you know, just such a magnetic force to me that, you know, I had to be a part of it.
Well, you moved there in 65, big music scene at the time. You joined a folk group in the late 60s called Wind in the Willows as a backup singer. What got you into that group?
Well, my best friend from high school actually was married to the founder of that band, of that group. And so I was just, you know, hanging around with her. And, you know, he would be writing songs or something like that. And I, you know, started singing like a high harmony or something. And, you know, I just sort of fell into that. I can't really say that I was a creative force in that band or that group.
Well, and you did that. You were a go-go dancer. You were Playboy Bunny for a little bit. But from 69 to 73, you kind of took a little bit of a break, and then you jumped back in. What made you give yourself some breathing room there?
Well, I don't know. I guess I had to, you know, find another approach into that thing. I sort of felt uncomfortable in the music business, and I think that it was sort of a case of misdirection at first. And, I guess that I didn't really identify with it, you know, creatively, and did not feel comfortable. I felt misrepresented, you know, in that era, I guess, and I had to sort of wait until there was a, you know...
The right thing came along.
Yeah, a big empty spot where something new could be, you know, brought out.
Sure. Well, you joined the Stilettos in 74. You met your longtime collaborator, Chris Stein, and then came Angel and the Snake, and then Blondie. How did Blondie come about?
Well, we had the name Angel and the Snake, and we had, just tossed around different names, and we knew that Angel and the Snake wasn't going to really work. Felt a little too cumbersome and perhaps retro at that time. And just Blondie sort of seems so direct and to the point and sort of a little bit weird and crazy after the comic strip. And I don't know, it seems somehow appropriate.
Is that what the name came from?
It was, yeah, well, partially. I think it was... just because, you know, I had bleached my hair and,
sure.
you know, people started saying, "Blay Blondie." So it seemed pretty obvious. And I also felt that, you know, when you choose a name like that, you sort of have to find something that's already registers in people's minds.
Sure.
As if you're, you know, trying to do something that's commercial or, you know, has commercial potential, that, you know, it has to be sort of something that already exists in people's minds. But yet, it's, you know, has the potential also to be unique.
And tell me about the music club, the legendary music club, CBGB, country, bluegrass, and blues that you kind of really broke out in. And I was looking at the lineup. I mean, it was you, it was the Ramones, it was Talking Heads, it was later Elvis Costello, the Police, Joan Jett. What an iconic venue this was.
Yes, it was very exciting. Television came out of there. A lot of... Patty played there as well.
Yeah.
A lot of it was quite a good music scene. I think, you know, as music scenes go, you know, as with, you know, the San Francisco scene and the LA scene, they sort of gather momentum. You know, it becomes people are drawn to it. You know, especially musicians, because they want to see what everybody else is doing. So it's sort of like a natural force in a way.
Well, you know, and this was kind of a boys' club. How did you break through? Like, what would you attribute to you breaking through and making a difference? Because, I mean, you really made it, it was groundbreaking.
I think, there were a number of us there, not too many, and of course there weren't very many girls in the business then. But, you know, I think it was just an idea whose time had come, you know, and I felt determined. I felt that this was something that I had to do. You know, I had an obsession with it. And I was fortunate in that, you know, I had a wonderful partner, and we had a great time together. And, you know, there were really good girls there, though there weren't that many. And, you know, I had a stubborn streak. I perhaps still have it.
That's what makes you who you are, though. I mean, you know, I love the edginess about you, and I think that's what has made you. That's part of your success story.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be able to stand up for yourself somehow. You know, it doesn't have to be in the biggest way, and it's surprising. You know, like when you do stand up for something that you really feel you must. It can be something that's very trivial, but it really gives you a great sense of yourself. And I think it's amazing. You just never know where it's going to lead.
That's right. No, that's right. And then your debut album came out in 76. And when I first heard Ripper to Shreds, I was like, wow, is there someone cool enough on the planet to write this? Because it wasn't just about the music. I mean, there's a lot of artists, it's just about the music or it's just about the lyrics. There was a great combination of both.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a tribute in a way, an homage to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground with that, you know, the feel of the music. Or we tried to make it like that. It wasn't wasn't quite exactly that. It was sort of a combination between punk and Lou Reed. And then the lyric was a sort of a parody, really, self-parody in some respects. And, you know, just sort of what, you know, what people get up to, you know, talking about one another or, you know, being bitchy. Mm-hmm. Get the bitch on.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, then came, you know, Plastic Letters and came, you know, Parallel Lines, which reached number one in the UK, number six in the US, Heart of Glass, one way or another. You know, sold well over 20 million copies. And then in 79, you were on the cover of Rolling Stone. At what point did you say to yourself, wow, we've made it. We are on our way. This is it. What point of that era did you say that to yourself?
Well, I think, you know, once we started recording and it was, you know, I mean, nowadays you can record and it, very easily you can do it. But then, you know, you really had to have somebody interested in you via a label or management to make it possible to really record. And I think once we realized that, you know, somebody wanted to record what we were doing, that we were definitely, you know, in it, you know, in it to win it or whatever,
sure.
You know, however
sure.
You want to put it.
Debbie Harry, the underground punk Harlow, is the star of Blondie. She looks the part. The members of Blondie have become important figures, if not heroes, to the dozens of new wave acts seeking widespread acceptance in this country and the latest overnight sensations in a diverse late 70s rock boom that includes Elvis Costello, The Police, Cars, Dire Straits. The band shattered the new wave stigma of non-commercialism. Since Blondie's inception in 75, Debbie has been a fashion trendsetter as well as a sex symbol. I think you've carried that along through your entire career.
It's quite a mouthful you just...
Yeah, right?
That was quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I always sort of laugh. I'm a little bit mystified, but then I understand, you know, being a fashion trendsetter, I know women that are very chic and very fashionable, and I definitely am not quite that person, but... I think what we did was we completely flipped the coin and went in the opposite direction to what the current sort of trends were across the country, and therefore became remarkable. And the second thing that helped me with that was working with a wonderful designer named Steve Sprouse, and he is actually from... I believe he's from Indiana, but I know he spent a lot of time up around the lakes in the summertime.
Oh, cool.
So he's, you know, he's one of you guys.
Yeah, gotcha. Midwesterners here. You know, and here's the thing, too. You know, all the success, and then you were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, of course, you know, being a punk, I had to scoff at it. You know, I had to sort of say, oh, who wants that? You know, but then when it happened, I said, oh, wow, this is kind of great. You know, look at all these great people. And to be a part of that, you know, I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing, really.
And are you, and I'm going to come see you when you're here on Friday. And I have to ask you, you know, are you noticing a mix in your audiences? Is it baby boomers, young people, fans that just want to hear the hits? Like, what are you seeing in the crowds? I have a 15-year-old son who, when I was playing some of the music yesterday, telling him that I was going to talk to you today, and he knows every one of your songs. So, I mean, you're really crossing so many different generations these days.
Yeah. Well, I have always appreciated that and loved it. And I think it's one of the things about Blondie that, you know, has been consistent, honestly, since the very beginning. And our record company people back in the dark ages, they always remarked about that our, you know, our demographic was very, very spread. You know, there was no limitation to it. You know, we appealed to a lot of different age groups. So, you know, I can live with that. I think today it's changed in a way, you know, because of the availability of music. It's so easy to get and to, you know, anybody can listen to whatever they want. And I think in radio it has changed too. I think that radio is not so, you know, prescribed, you know,
right.
It's not so, you know, your playlists are much bigger and can cover a lot of different eras. And it really makes sense, you know, it's our culture and it's what we listen to, it's what moves us, it's our daily lives, you know.
Now, you know, on stage and in your songs, because it's an art form, I think, of what you do. You use your sexuality in almost a way that turned into an art form. It was sexual, not vulgar. But how do you feel about some of the new artists who try to copy things like that? I mean, are they hitting the right notes when it comes to that?
I don't know. I'm kind of amazed and in awe of so many of the newer and younger artists. I just think they're sensational music now, and you know, when you see somebody with a strong personality and, you know, really putting it all in there and where it counts, it may not necessarily be my own personal taste, but I always have to, really admire them. You know, I mean, it takes some guts to really get up and to be that person, you know?
Sure. Sure. Before I let you go, I want to ask you this. The official video for Blondie's Heart of Glass on YouTube has been viewed like 49 million times. There's over a million other Blondie videos on YouTube, most of them from unofficial accounts, you know, with hundreds of millions of views. Yet you guys really don't receive a fair amount of royalties from these millions of plays. In fact, it's estimated that YouTube only plays a sixth of what Apple and Spotify pays artists. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think I wrote something about that, and I feel that, you know, that the technology has moved very quickly, and this is something that has been sort of plaguing the industry since the 60s, really, at least the early 70s.
Yeah.
From going into the cassettes and the DATs and the 8-tracks and so on. I think it's best said by one of the label people years ago said, "Oh my God, they can just copy the music."
Yeah.
Like it suddenly realized that, you know, anybody could make a copy, you know, and that was it. So I think it's been a deal that's been going on, but it hasn't covered, you know, authorship and writers, you know, hasn't protected the writers and the artists correctly, and I think that's something that has to be remedied, and we will, you know, we have to stand up for our rights.
Absolutely have to, because I'll tell you, if you're selling a piece of artwork and you're copying it, of course you're going to get, that's a federal crime. Like, why isn't, you know, copying music or playing music on certain things something that you should be getting paid for? Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful article that's much more extensive than mine, and the article is extraordinary. It's wonderful. Great language, really in-depth, and well worth reading.
What is your proudest moment in your 40-year-plus history, or those days to yet to come?
Oh. I don't know. You know, I guess some of the bigger festivals that we've played, you know, when it gets over 100,000 people, you know, you just sort of say, what the, you know, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah.
that's kind of, it just, the power of that is so exciting. And it just makes you want to melt, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm excited about seeing you this coming Friday. And again, Debbie Harry and Blondie will be at the Genesee Theater in Waukegan on Friday, June 10th. And for tickets, you can visit GenesseeTheater.com. And for more on Blondie, visit Blondie.net. And for everything Debbie, visit DeborahHarry.com. Always a pleasure talking to you, and what a thrill to spend a little time with you tonight.
Well, thank you so much for the your boost and all of your, you know, all of the attention to detail. And when you come to the show, please come and say hello.
I will do that. We'll see you next Friday then.
Okay, bye, David.
All right, thanks again. Bye-bye. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Oh, that's Pep Benatar spinning the tunes. Hit me with your best shot from 1981 here on WGN.
Yeah. Rock and roll for you. In the early morning in Chicago, WGN, we got Pep Benatar.
Let's get Eddie Volkman in here to do this. or Fred Winston. Come on, it'll be fun.
Oh, man. Yeah, I love worked Fred. With Fred a little bit.
Did you?
Back after I left Q101, after they let go like 90% of the news department, I started... You know, piddling around town a little bit and worked over at WCFL for a little bit, filling in at the news department.
That's cool.
And Fred was doing shows, and I was a guest anchor, fill-in anchor for a while. Very, very cool. He's a great guy. Great guy. And then later on, when I worked at the coffee company, Gloria Jean's,
yeah,
he was close friends with the owner
of
the company. So they used to hang out a lot.
He did some stuff for us for the Radio Hall of Fame, but just such a classic voice that I grew up on LSM.
Yeah.
So the best, most impactful women in rock and roll in the history of rock, Deborah Harry's on this list that I pulled. I got a couple texters come in and we'll talk about these people as well, but 847 says Anna Nancy Wilson made the biggest impact on rock and roll. Chrissy Hynde, what amazing guitarist, agree on that as well. And of course, Pat Benatar. But Pat, and by the way, you know, this is pretty cool because I was thinking about this. I was talking with, Andrea Darlis about this because she and I are actually going to go to the Blondie concert next Friday.
Oh, cool.
And we're talking about this classic rock and roll. I've had Pat Benatar on the show for almost an hour. Absolutely fascinating story and terrific woman. And I've had Joan Jett. That was probably one of the interviews I had to edit the most because, you know, some of these interviews, conversations I have overnight, folks, obviously, some of them I do have earlier in the day or during the week because they won't quite get up with me, but I want to bring those conversations to you. But, yeah, Joan Jett, there was a lot of language flying around on that one,
really?
As you could imagine. But Pat Benatar, she was a bank teller. And, you know, success began on her first album, In the Heat of the Night, in 1979. Her second album, Crimes of Passion, put her in an ideal position to become one of the first most frequently played artists on MTV when she launched in 1981. And again, the first album was in the Heat of the Night. Chrissy Hynde, somebody mentioned, after spending much of the 70s trying unsuccessfully to form or permanently join a band, she finally got her demo tape to a record label owner whose backing enabled her to put together The Pretenders. On the strength, their self-titled album in 1979, the band wrote the new wave movement until the 1980s. So, of course, on The Pretenders, Joan Jett, as you're hearing a little bit in the background now, after success in the mid-70s with The Runaways. I don't know if you remember The Runaways, but that was a classic band in the early, cool rock and roll band in the early 70s. Her first album was I Love Rock and Roll from 1981, became an immediate hit. I remember meeting Joan back in 1986. So I was in the music industry. I was on the retail side, the marketing side of the industry.
Right.
And I remember it was the most awkward thing because, first of all, she was young. She was beautiful. She had a huge entourage.
Mm-hmm.
But we went to Ditka's for dinner.
Oh, cool.
But with Joan Jett, that didn't seem like the edgy, cool place you'd take Joan Jett. You know what I'm saying?
But yeah, that's where the but I mean, if they got her. Good food, I mean.
That's true. That's true.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Let's see here. So Joan Jett, of course, and then Janis Joplin. I don't think there's list that you could even talk about in rock and roll without Janis Joplin. One of the first female artists to break the girl singer mold that existed in folk and pop music in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
Her fusion of rock and blues influenced both male and female artists. Her breakthrough came after performing with Big Brother and the Holding Company at the Monterey Pop Festival in 67, the year I was born, Roger. She performed in Woodstock in 69. She was approaching the height of her success in 70 when she died of a drug and alcohol overdose. Best known song, would you say, Janis Joplin? What would be your best song?
Oh, God.
Say Pieces of My Heart. Probably one of the classic ones. Yeah.
That was very classic, but there are a couple of other ones where she did covers of some blues, some traditional blues songs that just blow me away. Seriously. She put her entire body into the song.
Yeah, she did. Oh, my gosh.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just great.
Amazing to watch.
Yeah.
From a performance standpoint.
Yeah.
Stevie Nicks established herself as a major vocal and songwriting talent, and I got one from 414 that mentioned Stevie Nicks with Fleetwood Mac, which she joined in 1975. While still a member of the band, she also launched a solo career in 81.
Mm-hmm.
which was fabulous. But Fleetwood Mac was her first album in 75. I'm going to say Dreams.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite Fleetwood Mac song.
I remember when that album came out. I was over at a friend's apartment, and it had just come out, and they put it on, and I'm blown away.
I'd like to see them back on stage, because I don't think they're touring at all right now. I'd love to see them back on stage.
Yeah.
Here's one that makes every list that really surprises me. And by the way, if you want to jump into the conversation on the phone or via text, 312-981-7200, Suzy Quatro.
You know, I know of her. I mean, I remember her.
She was...
But I didn't think...
Leather Tuscadero on Happy Days.
Yeah, I know.
That's how she got Dashiell.
I think that's her bigger claim to fame than really...
Pinky's younger sister.
Music.
Pinky's younger sister. Yeah. She's still... You know what? No, you know what? Let me explain. She was the first female bass guitarist to become a major rocker. Her sister, Patty Quatro, had blazed a trail as a member of Fanny, one of the first female rock bands to sign with a major record label. A long list of artists cites Suzy as a major influence on their work, including two on this list, Joan Jett, who she talked about when I interviewed Joan, mm-hmm. and Chrissy Hynde. She got her first big break in the UK in 71 when she came to the attention of producer Mickey Most, who had nurtured artists like The Animals, the Jeff Beck Group, Donovan, Herman's Hermits. She started getting attention in her native America when she had a recurring role on the TV series Happy Days.
Yeah.
And released Stumbling In, a duet with British vocalist Chris Norman in 1978. So her first album was 73, and she still tours. I mean, you can see, you know, Suzy Quatro still plays all the little arenas and all that other mm-hmm. good stuff, but she was kind of a garage rock. You can say rock, you can say hard rock. She was kind mm-hmm. of garage rock to me. But I remember she was kind of like wicked cool in the 70s being on Happy Days. It was just odd because... I'm going to digress for a minute here. I was a big Happy Days fan. That's like right. That was like my go-to Brady Bunch type of show that mm-hmm. I grew up with. And the 50s were the 50s in the early episodes and maybe a little dip into the 60s. And then all of a sudden they had the 70s sensibility in this show that was about the 50s. And I just didn't
It didn't get, work.
It didn't quite work.
Yeah,
well.
They lost me. When she came out, I'm going, what the heck is this? Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
Suzy is an awesome girl bassist from 630. Absolutely. Absolutely is. Grace Slick,
yeah.
You know, sometimes haunting voice, and mm-hmm. I would describe her best by letting it all hang out type of thing.
Yeah.
Which she once removed her blouse on stage, so I think that's a very accurate statement. But Jefferson Airplane, Starship. By the time
Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah.
Once they became the Starship, it's like now they became too commercial.
Jefferson Starship, not as much as Starship. Starship in the 80s was, that was tough to listen to.
Yeah.
But as a songwriter, she's responsible for two of the best-known songs, White Rabbit and mm-hmm. Somebody to Love. She retired from music, and I didn't know this, in 1989. So she retired a long time ago already and began painting and drawing professionally.
Mm.
So psychedelic, hard rock, blues rock, singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist. So she played many different instruments as well. And she was say to influence Patti Smith and Stevie Nicks,
mm-hmm.
believe it or not.
Yeah.
Speaking of Patti Smith, she's been nicknamed Godmother of Punk, which I think,
really?
A lot of people say that Blondie was a Godmother of Punk, but out of the art, but the artist Patti Smith have influenced run on the gamut, from U2 to Shirley Manson. Her classic debut album Horses in 75 found a place on the greatest albums list of magazines like Rolling Stone, Time, an NME. In addition to performing, she's also a prolific author and social activist. So again, her first album was called Horses. Best known song, which was co-written by Bruce Springsteen, was Because the Night.
Because the Night.
That's
it sounds like
known.
A Springsteen song.
Now
you know?
That you think about that, right?
Yeah.
Artists that she influenced, U2, Michael Stipe from REM, mm-hmm. Shirley Manson from Garbage, Sonic Youth, The Smiths. So pretty cool. Number 9, Nan and Anna Nancy Wilson.
Yeah, Heart.
Heart. Which, tried to get. Those are two women that I have tried to get on the show quite frequently. I can never get them. It's always, they don't do interviews while they're on tour. But on tour is when I want to talk to them when they're coming to Chicago, because they're in that groove. But when Heart came out in 73, it soon became clear the two women, they were lovely, and still are, sisters no less. Fronting mm-hmm. a rock band was way more than a young man's fantasy. After their debut album, Dreamboat Annie in 75, Anne and Nancy have had top 10 albums in every decade since.
Wow.
Isn't that pretty cool?
That is cool. Yeah.
So more of a progressive rock, more of a folk rock.
A little more commercial rock. I remember
Magic Man, Crazy.
Yeah, I remember back in Vegas, I was working at a station. It was an eclectic mix of things. We had a three-hour jazz show at night. Then we had a rock and roll show. Then we broke at midnight for the CBS Mystery Theater. And then we came back with rock and roll. And I remember playing a lot of Heart at that time. And then Taste of Chicago in Grant Park, I can't remember how long ago now.
Yeah.
10, 12 years ago maybe, Heart was on the bill, and they just blew everyone away.
I bet they did.
It was awesome.
I bet they did. And number 10, Debbie Harry, Blondie.
Yeah.
So there you have it. 6-3 also, or 289 throws in Linda Ronstadt as well. So there you have it, the women who most influenced rock. All right, we're going to talk about America's Cup coming to Chicago next on 720 WGN.